Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Between 1995 and 2004, more than 300 coal miners died in accidents, but more than 10,000 died from black lung disease. In 1969, a law was passed to impose safety standards for miners, including limits to coal dust exposure. Well, here we are 51 years later, and thousands of coal miners are still suffering and dying from black lung disease. In his new book, Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia, today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hamby, writes about the tens of thousands of coal miners who've been fighting to receive black lung disability benefits. He also exposes the mining industry and its army of high-profile lawyers, doctors, and lobbyists who do whatever it takes to deny coal miners meager benefits. We're talking about $700 a month. Chris Hamby writes, quote, "The American coal industry has a virtually unmatched record of death, disease, and destruction. And for more than a century, many of King Coal's worst excesses have been concentrated in central Appalachia, with southern West Virginia at its core. For the underground miner, the possibility of death or crippling injury is ever present. At any given moment, the miner could be asphyxiated, crushed, drowned, burned alive, or blown up. Though surface mines account for the greater share of production in the United States today, underground mines employ more workers. The underground miner goes to work in the middle of a layer cake," end quote. Chris Hamby is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2014 and was a finalist for the prize in international reporting in 2017. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on such an important book. One reviewer at the Star Tribune, Chris Serres, said that you really performed a public service by portraying the often forgotten people of coal country as active agents in their own history. And it really made us think about how, you know, during the election, coal miners are often used in speeches, although not this election. And the media talks about what politicians say about coal miners, but you rarely hear about the coal miners themselves and what they've been through.
That's completely true. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book is that, we rarely hear from the miners themselves. They're frequently invoked to sort of push policy positions on one side or the other, and they are people just like you and me, and they have a complex set of ideas and opinions, and I wanted to really in this book show kind of an intimate portrayal of hopefully who coal miners actually are, and I hope I've accomplished that primarily through, focusing on a couple of people in particular. But it just has really meant a lot to me to get to know these people over time on a deeper basis than they're frequently invoked in sound bites.
Let's talk about how you started on this journey. You write, "The breath of a coal miner stricken with advanced black lung disease often has a distinct and haunting timbre. It's a hoarse gasp, a desperate attempt to draw in the oxygen that the body needs to sustain itself, an audible representation of the losing battle being waged every minute of every day inside scarred and shriveled lungs." And you write that the first time you actually heard this sound was in the spring of 2011. So take us back to that time and talk about how you began this journey.
Yeah. So in 2011, I was a relatively novice reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, which is a nonprofit news investigation outlet here in Washington, where I am. And so I was on a team that was focusing on environmental and labor issues, and we had gotten an advance copy of a report from the governor's task force that had been appointed to look into the Upper Big Branch mine disaster from 2010, which was the worst coal mine disaster in 40 years. It killed 29 men, A lot of people may remember Massey Energy Company. It was one of their mines. And so we knew that other news outlets had gotten had also gotten copies of this embargoed report, and we were looking to differentiate our story from what some of the others might be out there. And we noticed that there was just one page in this report is kind of a sidebar almost that said that they'd been able to do autopsies on most of the miners, and a startling proportion of them had black lung. And this included younger miners, miners with not a lot of experience underground. And then it just sort of noted as an aside almost that this fit within the larger picture that government researchers had been starting to document in recent years, which was that the disease that was supposed to have been eradicated by now is actually resurgent. And, you know, now today it has reached the severe form of the disease has reached the highest levels ever recorded.
So to get a little specific, you report that of the 29 victims, 24 had enough lung tissue for pathologists to examine during autopsies. And of those, 17 had black lung. The victims ranged in age from 25 to 61. And Chris, as you write, until I read that page, I thought, as many Americans probably do, that black lung was a historical relic.
That's absolutely right. I mean, to me, that revelation in that one page sort of sparked what has been the last, I don't know, it's sort of an obsession over, I suppose you could say, over the last 9 years for me, because it ultimately, the obvious question that follows from that is, well, why? What's going on here? I mean, and especially once, you know, I read a little bit on the history and learned that in 1969, basically, you know, coal miners themselves had risen up with wildcat strikes and forced recognition of this disease, and they had forced one of the strongest pieces of health and safety legislation ever passed. And in that legislation, you know, we basically, acting through Congress, made two promises to the nation's coal miners, which was that, you know, we knew how to eradicate this disease. You control the dust. And so that we were going to force companies to do that. And then in the meantime, we were going to provide fair compensation for those who got the disease. You know, so by the point when I was reading this report in 2011, you know, those things were supposed to have been basically accomplished. I mean, the disease should have been virtually eradicated, and there should have been virtually no need for a benefits system anymore. Yet we were now seeing this uptick in disease, and I was hearing all of these problems about the benefit system and growing backlogs and injustices. And it really set me off, I guess, first of all, to look into why the disease was surging back, and then later into the benefit system in more detail.
This is often, you know, forgotten history. You talk about what happened in November of 1968. You write about the explosion that ripped through the underground tunnels of the Consolidation Coal Company's number 9 mine in Farmington, West Virginia. 78 miners were killed in what amounted to the worst mining disaster in almost two decades. And workers, with the help of doctors and lawyers, started pushing for this legislation to give them some kind of compensation. And as you write, within just a couple days, 40,000 workers across West Virginia took part in one of the largest political strikes in U.S. history. Can you tell us just a little bit more about what you learned about that moment?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the book is obviously more of a focuses more on recent events, but I tried to get in as much history as I could because it's a fascinating one. And, you know, there were some things that I just wasn't able to include for space reasons. But, you know, the wildcat strikes of 1968 and 1969 were really remarkable in that this was a period in time in which you had the political and medical establishments and the industry itself saying essentially black lung doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it only is disabling in very small number of cases. I mean, and this was, and even their own coal miners' union at the time was not supportive of them. And so you had miners themselves, rank and file miners, connecting with, you know, community organizers who would arrive there as part of the war on poverty. And one of the two main characters in my book ends up being one of those people who sticks with it for until the present and becomes a lawyer. But, you know, they meet up with basically these organizers and this small handful of sort of doctors who are willing to speak out and say black lung is real and we need to do the basic steps to prevent it and compensate people who get it. And this was a really a it was an inspiring grassroots uprising where they essentially defied their own union, the legal and medical establishments, and shut down the coal industry in West Virginia and won a strong state law, but really pushed further. And what was more consequential was winning in 1969, going on to win the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act that year, which is what I was describing earlier that made these two promises to miners that remain unfulfilled today.
You know, and we'll go into detail about why this law didn't stick and protect miners like it was supposed to. I mean, you write a lot about the doctors, the lawyers, the lobbyists who work for these coal companies. But how, I mean, before we get into detail, how would you describe this? And how would you answer that question, Chris? Why, what happened to this law? Because it seemed like it was pretty strong in 1969.
It did. And I think there are a couple of things. So on the prevention side, there were a number of significant loopholes that allowed what it set up was essentially a monitoring system in which it the government heavily relied on coal companies to police themselves. That ultimate, and then you add on top of that the fact that they're sort of loopholes in the regulations that allowed for gamesmanship. And then there's a long history, really sort of, you know, once you start looking at it, almost an open secret within the industry that that fraud on these samples was just rampant and to some degree still is. In other words, that coal companies would basically fake the samples, or take samples that did not reflect what the miners were actually breathing. And the reasons for that are fairly simple is because, you know, there are basic steps that you can take to prevent miners from breathing excessive amounts of dust. And those are things like keeping the air flowing through your mine, basically, with proper ventilation. And that means things like hanging, you know, curtains and, you know, cutting in a specific order. But the problem is that all of those things take time for the miners to do them. And while they're doing those things to maintain a safe environment, they can't be mining coal. And, that obviously has been regarded as sort of downtime or uncompensated time of some sort, you know, time when they're not making money for the company. So, companies have proved incredibly creative at figuring out ways to make samples appear that they are in compliance with the law when they're actually not, and they're exposing miners to dangerous levels of dust. And what they tell the miners then is, well, these limits that the government has imposed on us are unrealistic, and if we actually have to comply with those, then we won't be able to make any money, and we'll have to shut down the mines, and then you'll be out of a job, and is that what you want? So it puts these miners in a horrible situation. And then on the back end, there are a lot of reasons why the benefits system has become so complex and so contentious. And that has to do a lot with the influence of, you know, very well credentialed and compensated doctors and lawyers, and be happy to get into that in more detail if you'd like.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. Today we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Chris Hamby about his new book, Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. Chris, can you just tell us some basic information about what it is like to work in a coal mine? One of the workers you follow closely in the book is Gary Fox, a longtime miner who was diagnosed with the most severe case of black lung disease. As you write, Gary worked in a coal mine for more than 30 years, and he worked sometimes 9 hours underground. Can you just describe what that's like for us?
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's one thing that I really hope I've conveyed in the book is the realities, just the harsh realities of what mining is and how difficult it is. And, I came to enjoy talking with a lot of miners about their work, because it is really fascinating when you learn about it. It's not as simple as people think. But Gary Fox is, you know, one of the two main characters in this book. And, he was a roof bolter. And so what his job was is most there are now these huge machines that basically shave off panels of coal. They're called long walls. But it's more common still to have underground sections use continuous mining machines, which are sort of like these. They have this spinning drum head with carbide tip teeth that just chew through a coal seam. And you kind of carve out a 20 by 20 room. That may be about, you know, it could be anywhere from 6 to 10 feet high, but sometimes these guys are working in what's called low coal, which could be, you know, maybe 4 feet high. So you're crawling for entire shifts. But, you know, Gary's job as a roof bolter then is to go into this newly cut section and to drive metal bolts through unstable layers of rock in the roof to try and render a cave-in less likely. And so the rest of the crew really depended on him and all roof bolters to make sure that the whole mountain doesn't collapse upon them. But there's just so many things about mining in particular that are so fascinating, and so many things that you have to watch for, that these guys have become, you know, keenly attuned to all the things that could be dangers to them in there. And there are so many from water coming into flood, from, you know, roof falls to rocks dribbling off the side, indicating certain sorts of problems. I mean, it's just, there are so many ways that you could die in this environment that, you know, even just surviving for a full career is really an accomplishment. And these guys have a very well earned sense of pride in the work that they do.
You also write that they're so directly connected to these companies. I mean, working 9 hours a day, in some cases they're on call, where if they get a call, they have to go back to work. They spend more time in the mine than they do with their families in many instances.
That's true. And it's, you know, I think companies are keenly aware that this is by far the best job available to these people in many of the regions where there is, you know, in Central Appalachia, for example, it is the best paying job with the best benefits. And, you know, what comes with that is that you work on the company's terms, generally, is what has been the case. And, you know, it's a really hard trade-off for people, and that's one thing that you know I explored particularly through Gary Fox's experience in the book, is that, you know, he was intently focused on providing a better life for his family than he'd had when he was, you know, growing up poor in an old coal camp, but what that meant was that he often didn't see his family, because he was, you know, because of his shifts, he would never really get to see his daughter as she was growing up. They wouldn't get to just sit around the kitchen table. He didn't get to take pictures with her before the high school prom. You know, just all the basic things. And so it's just a really, it's a horrible sort of sacrifice that the miners are often forced to make, to provide for their family means missing key parts of their family life and spending much of their time in some of the harshest conditions fathomable.
What is the average pay like?
It varies, but with bonuses, I've told that you can, you know, make $80,000 at least a year, which obviously goes a long way in a lot of these areas. It's definitely, you know, it varies some, but $80,000, I mean, you know, there's sort of a there was a saying that I heard a lot there where, you know, where else could, you know, someone with a no college education, you know, go in the area and make $80,000 a year. I mean, that's, you know, that's why this is the best job in the area.
And we're talking about billion-dollar companies, right? I mean, we talked about Massey, the report that you got your hands on. And in 2011, Alpha bought Massey for about $7 billion. I'm looking at some Forbes articles. It looks like the CEOs of some of these companies make, you know, millions of dollars, 10 to 12 million a year. And these companies are, well, Massey was valued at $6 billion back in 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously these are large, traditionally have been profitable, although the industry is really, you know, struggling right, more recently. And, you know, that obviously is some to do with environmental regulation, but more to do with market forces and just coal being driven out as a fuel source by natural gas, particularly thanks to the fracking boom. But, you know, I mean, I think the sort of disparity in the amount of money that the coal companies spend on certain things is probably most stark when you look at how much they're paying, how much they pay to fight these black lung benefits claims and how much they would actually have to pay the miners if they won. You know, I think as you noted earlier, the typical benefits even today are sort of in the range of $700 to a little over $1,000 a month. And that's, you know, if you have multiple dependents. Coal companies, you know, for instance, we found that they were paying, you know, $750 for one CT scan reading from a prominent expert. And they would do this, you know, over and over again. So, you know, it's not like they don't have the resources. It's just how they choose to deploy them.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Chris Hamby, an investigative reporter with The New York Times. He's author of Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. And one quick statistic, between 1995 and 2004, more than 300 coal miners died in accidents, but more than 10,000 died from black lung disease. We're talking about how the companies pay doctors, lawyers, and lobbyists a lot of money to fight these cases, even though the benefit payout would be about $700 a month. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby about his new book, Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. Chris, we have a comment from Marianne who writes, my Lithuanian immigrant coal miner grandfather died in Forest City, Pennsylvania in 1930 at the age of 49. At the time, black lung was called coal miner's asthma. My dad talked about how he struggled to breathe and even drank kerosene to see if it would help him breathe. And when he died, his three sons were orphaned. Wow. Thank you for that email, Marianne. I'm sorry to hear about your grandfather. At such a young age, Chris, just 49. And this was in 1930.
That's incredible. And that's just, I'm so sorry to hear that that happened. Unfortunately, that was not necessarily unusual at that time. And this gets into the really sort of shameful history of this disease in this country, which is that, you know, in the late 19th century, there was, I mean, by then there was already broad awareness that this was a distinct disease that was afflicting coal miners. And the really at the turn of the century, there was a concerted disinformation campaign mounted by the industry and some of their allies in the medical profession to discount the fact that this was even a problem. They even went so far as to claim that, you know, a little bit of coal dust is good for you and might protect you from tuberculosis. You know, this obviously has since been proven to be completely untrue, but it left miners in a situation where they were not only denied any sort of compensation for this, but, you know, as the commenter mentioned, you know, they were left to try and come up with all of these, you know, folk remedies to do something because it was obvious to them what was causing their poor health. And so, yes, you would hear about all these sort of concoctions that people would drink that were supposedly supposed to help, you know, get rid of some of the dust and prevent you from becoming extremely ill. But you had a horrible situation where you had guys who were, you know, basically left in that exact situation where they're in their 40s and they're still, you know, dying from this entirely preventable disease. And that's what's been really discouraging recently, is that part of this resurgence of disease, it's not just that the overall disease levels, but it's the fact that there has been a particular resurgence of severe disease, and in particular among younger miners. And we're again seeing miners in their 40s and 50s with advanced disease. And that really should not be the case. It should not have been the case in 1930, and it certainly should not be the case in 2020.
Hmm. What did you learn about the resurgence? What's behind it?
So there are a few leading theories, but I think it's pretty well established now that, you know, one of them is, for economic reasons, it is now feasible and profitable for companies to cut through large amounts of rock. Previously, you know, coal seams are surrounded by layers of rock, and very often that rock contains high concentrations of a particularly toxic mineral called silica. It's in quartz. It's kind of those shiny, jagged little crystals that you sometimes see. But if you can imagine those getting ground up really finely into little crystals and getting their way into your lungs, you have an idea of what silicosis is, which we're seeing disease now that resembles a mix of sort of a combination of black lung and silicosis, which is caused by coal dust and silica. And it really is leading to severe, fast-progressing disease. And the reason that's happening is because throughout Appalachia, much of Appalachia, there are some thin seams of coal. In other words, the coal seam itself may only be a few feet high, and it's surrounded on either side by rock. And companies didn't want to basically tear up their machines and spend all their time, running to cut all that rock surrounding the coal. But it is now actually feasible with more powerful machines and with sort of some of the economic incentives around coal as they are, to go after that. And so you have, I've talked to a number of guys who would say that they would just cut pure rock for hours and hours on end. And I think there's a lot of evidence both on x-rays and in pathological specimens now that's what these guys have. And, it's extremely concerning.
What were the conversations like when you spoke with the young miners of today, given how much we know about black lung disease, about the cozy relationship between the companies, government officials, lawyers, doctors? Just, can you give us an idea of just what some of those conversations were like?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things, is that it's very difficult to speak with a lot of younger miners today, because for a lot of reasons, and this has always been the case, but miners who are working, still actively working, in many respects are hesitant about speaking with a journalist. And they don't want to be perceived as saying anything that could be negative for the company, because, they realize they depend very heavily on this job, and there is a not unreasonable belief that you can get blacklisted for speaking up. Miners a lot of times, will not, and that carries over into, hampering disease surveillance and things like that, where the government is trying to get a handle on how widespread this resurgence is, but a lot of miners don't want to get tested, get the basic screening tests, including an x-ray, because they don't want to know the answer, one, and they don't want, because it might force them to stop working, and then two, they don't want companies to think that they might be sick and that they could be potentially stuck with this liability for them down the line. They think that the companies may get rid of them if they think these people are going to ultimately have black lung benefits cases that they're going to have to pay. So, it's very difficult to speak with working miners, unfortunately. I've spoken with a number of older miners, or relatively older miners, who have expressed regret sometimes, said they wish they'd done more when they were working to lessen the dust exposure, and that they wished they hadn't gone along with the company's sort of insistence on not following all the rules, but that they were doing the best that they could and trying to provide for their family. And so, these are really hard decisions that these guys are faced with, and it's hard to really even conceive of them as decisions in a lot of cases.
Are these young miners protected by a union? And I guess the next logical question is, what does that protection even mean? Because as you write in your book, when some of the older miners would file grievances, the company would respond with threats of retaliation, and the miner almost always ended up dropping the complaint.
Well, I think, the union has really, there is still the United Mine Workers Union, and they are one of the more active and potent unions that exist today, but they're certainly not what they once were. The primary character in the book, Gary Fox, he goes to work for Massey Energy, in the latter part of his career. And, you know, you, we were speaking some about that company earlier, and they really in the 1980s made a concerted effort to essentially break the union in southern West Virginia, and they did so fairly effectively, starting at the complex where Gary Fox worked in southern West Virginia. And, you know, there's been sort of an erosion since then. So, you know, there is some protection there, but, you know, I think miners have always had the sense somewhat that you have to look out for yourself as well.
Today we're speaking with New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby about his new book, Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. Let's spend a little time talking about just how difficult it is for these coal miners to actually fight for benefits. You profile some people who work tirelessly to help these miners. John Klein, you write, is a rarity in the coal fields, a lawyer who is willing to help the miners navigate a very difficult legal system in pursuit of modest monthly payments and medical coverage. As we're talking about $700 a month. You write that most lawyers wouldn't touch these cases. Chris, just following the steps that miners have to take to make a case is just shocking. I mean, as you write, you know, as they're making their case, sometimes they would die and then their widows would have to fight on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the system is kind of it's kind of a bizarre creation in which it's neither a civil lawsuit where you can win a lot of money or a workers' compensation claim where where it's, you know, kind of easier to prove your case, but your payout is lower at the end. It's kind of in between. It combines the lower payout of the worker compensation claim with, you know, some of the contentiousness of a multimillion-dollar lawsuit. And, you know, you add on top of that the fact that it is basically there are all sorts of particular rules and there are no settlements. It's either all or nothing. And lawyers are barred from, you know, collecting fees basically until they ultimately win the case. And if they do, they have to petition, you know, for further to even get those benefits. And it's not like they're going to win a huge cut like they would in civil lawsuits. The fees are pretty capped. And so there's a real deterrent to anyone from representing miners within this system. And that's why John Klein has really stood out. I mean, he's sort of a remarkable character, and that's why I wanted to tell, you know, his story and the way that he and his life and the life of Gary Fox intersected in this really meaningful case with implications for a lot of miners. And, you know, John came to southern West Virginia in 1968 as part of the War on Poverty as a community organizer. He was originally from New York. And he ended up sticking around and becoming a carpenter and then running a home building business that built homes almost exclusively for people who qualified for the low interest government loans for people of modest means. And then he goes to work at a rural medical clinic. And it's there where he's, you know, assisting coal miners in getting basic treatment and filing medical benefits claims that he starts to see what he believes is sort of this manipulation of the system by the largest law firm that represents coal companies in these cases. And so he, you know, is sort of ultimately he goes back to law school at age 53 and becomes one of maybe 20 or 30 lawyers in the country who will actually handle these cases.
Wow. So he's basically, he's trying to unravel a scheme to defraud sick miners orchestrated by this law firm, the Jackson Kelly Law Firm. And as you write, they've got offices in Appalachia, Denver, Washington, and they defend companies accused of polluting the environment, marketing dangerous drugs, or discriminating against workers.
Yeah, this is the has long been the go-to firm for coal companies. And what John started to see in the early 1990s was he started to believe that they were withholding critical evidence in benefits cases that was causing miners to wrongfully be denied their claims. And he, case by case, meticulously sort of went about exposing this over, you know, in sort of a longstanding 15 year or so battle with this law firm. And ultimately, you know, other people started seeing what he was seeing, but it took a long time. And it ultimately led to some pretty remarkable reforms.
Can we talk about the coal miners and politics? Greg has a question. Do you know what is the ratio of black to white coal miners?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry. I mean, I do know that it is, you know, there's always been sort of a, you know, I've talked with a lot of guys of multiple, you know, who have always felt like they're sort of a solidarity, regardless of race, working in the coal mines. But, you know, I couldn't speak to those specific numbers.
Oh, Greg also writes, and Greg has some choice words for Mitch McConnell. He says, why do miners still support politicians like McConnell who've done nothing to help them in the last 50 years? And have, did you get into any of the politics around this, Chris?
Well, I tried not to discuss politics too much with these guys. We mainly talked about their jobs. And I think the things that they were more focused on were just basic ideas of fairness and justice in the legal structures that, you know, affected their lives. But, you know, I will say that you know, it's not necessarily, I mean, there are many complex considerations that affect how people vote, and certainly economic considerations are up there. You know, in terms of a region that is dependent on the coal industry, and it's not really their fault that they were born in an area where, you know, this is the dominant industry, and that we haven't really given them a lot of other options. You know, but I'll also say that a lot of guys I've spoken to are keenly aware of some of the actual policies that affect their lives, their safety, their health, and their pocketbooks. And those are things like the fact that there was a key provision as an amendment in the Affordable Care Act that has been greatly beneficial to helping miners win claims that they had been fighting to get for decades. The fact that you know, that they are very concerned about the trust fund that finances a lot of benefits is potentially going to become insolvent because Congress hasn't extended the tax that finances it, which is a tax on coal companies. So, you know, it cuts both ways, but I think that they are always more pragmatic than partisan when I've spoken with them about any of these issues.
The LA Times ran a piece in February called "In Coal Country, Trump Holds Sway Despite Failing to Revive the Industry." And there's a lot of people quoted in here saying that they're planning to vote for Trump. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, when you think about, you know, Trump really using coal miners during the election, saying he's going to bring coal back. I mean, we heard this over and over again in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult a calculation because you have to remember, you know, that miners didn't necessarily, I mean, the ones that I've spoken with didn't necessarily believe everything that Donald Trump was promising about, you know, completely reviving the industry. And I think a lot of miners themselves realized that that's unrealistic. But it's also important not to forget that, you know, his opponent in 2016, Hillary Clinton, in sort of trying to make a point about climate change, did say that, you know, there are going to be a lot of coal mines shutting down and coal miners out of work. I'm paraphrasing something along those lines. And that it's difficult to overstate how much impact that had. And it's just, so when you're in a region that's heavily dependent on coal for economic output, and you have someone making unrealistic promises, perhaps, but another person saying that they're going to shut down your mines, you can see how that would be a difficult choice.
Yeah, you just reminded us of this. So Hillary Clinton said in 2016, we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. And I'm just reading from Vox right now. She says that she regrets this comment the most, and she devoted an entire chapter to it in her book, What Happened. She said, the point I wanted to make was the exact opposite of how it came out, and she felt absolutely sick about the whole thing. But this is the kind of stuff that you just, yeah, it sticks, and people remember it.
It certainly was what I saw in talking with people.
But when you look at the policies, I mean, I remember seeing a video about, you know, people with black lung disease who finally got health care because of Obamacare. And then you have Trump wanting to get rid of it. I mean, that's just such a basic right for these guys. What do they say about that?
Well, you know, I have heard from people who are very concerned that if the Affordable Care Act is repealed or it in this or, you know, is ultimately invalidated as part of this court case that's ongoing, that the Trump administration has joined challenging it, that could be a really bad thing for coal miners. You know, I think they're aware of that. So that is definitely something that goes into their thinking politically.
Hmm. What do you think is at stake in this election? I'm not sure if you follow coal policies very closely, but as we were talking, I just got an email from Earth Justice that says, we're sending out an email about the finalization of the Trump administration's effluent limitation guidelines. The EPA has finalized this environmental rollback, weakening public health and water safety protections for millions across the United States. So the EPA is weakening rules on coal plants' toxic wastewater. The Obama administration rule is being weakened. The EPA announced it would improve, let's see, it would have prevented 1.4 billion pounds of pollutants from entering the U.S. waters each year. And the EPA is now weakening this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not familiar with the particular rule that you mentioned there, but I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's no secret that this administration has done numerous things to ease, as they describe it, ease regulations on the industry to try and spur them economically or just to address what they felt like was regulatory overreach from the past administration. So
we can just, I mean, obviously expect a lot more of this if Trump is reelected, a lot more deregulation. Final thoughts, Chris. You know, I mean, your book really lays out how these miners have to fight for $700 or $800 a month. I mean, even if they get to the point where the case will be heard, it's still an uphill battle because they have to have a medical, they have to be seen by a doctor from the coal industry and then a doctor from the government. You write that the Labor Department actually turns down about 85% of claims. So this is such an uphill battle. And you just have to wonder, what's in store for these young coal miners?
Well, that's really a good question. And that's a really important question to be asking right now, because, you know, even though the industry is not what it once was, you still have tens of thousands of people who are working under these conditions. And that's what's really troubling when we see this resurgence of disease is, you know, what it's important to ask the question, what do we need to be doing right now to make sure that this younger generation doesn't suffer the same burden of entirely preventable disease that the previous generations have? And I think there were some steps that were that have been taken recently that have been very positive in that direction, including a rule that was issued in 2014. But there are more steps that I think a lot of advocates feel would protect people who are mining coal currently. And one of them is a rule to address the silica specifically, which I was describing earlier, is the mineral that's in rock that is probably driving a lot of this resurgence of severe disease that we're seeing recently. And that's something that has, you know, is on the regulatory agenda, but a lot of advocates, I feel like, I've spoken with, I feel like that the Trump administration is essentially stalling on this, and they would like to see this rule pushed forward to protect miners in the future.
Chris Hamby is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. His new book is Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. Chris, thanks so much for this book, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find more about Chris and his work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.